Can you give us and our listeners one example of Native people's struggles and highlight for us some of the common issues they face and some of the strategies they use to defend their rights?
One of the hot spots right now is the situation in Colombia, where you have a small Native population, the Ua population, which is a small tribe of about 5,000 people that inhabit the Colombian cloud forests, and their lands have been targeted by the Occidental Petroleum Corporation, which is a Los Angeles-based oil corporation, for oil extraction. The oil exploration is on lands claimed by the Ua as part of their traditional land base. Since 1995, the Ua population has been resisting having their lands taken by Occidental and having the possibility of oil development taking place on their lands, which would destroy their existing subsistence lifestyle based on small farming, hunting, and fishing. The Occidental Petroleum Corporation has enlisted the assistance of the Colombian military, the police, private security firms that are protecting the oil company's property from demonstrations that are organized by the Ua in conjunction with their peasant neighbors and the non-Indian population in the surrounding area that have peacefully occupied the site, protesting the imposition of these oil activities on a population that has been right next to an area just north of the reservation, which has been subjected to an incredible amount of violence around the oil industry, because the British Petroleum Company and Shell Oil had developed that area in the last decade, which has resulted in massive oil spills that have destroyed the subsistence activity of the Indian populations in the area, and which have also been in the center of the conflict between the guerrilla armies, particularly the ELN and the FARC in Colombia, and the paramilitaries, which are the sort of subsidiary of the Colombian armies, which have been trained and equipped by the Defense Department, U.S. Defense Department, and the Central Intelligence Agency in much the same way that the death squads in El Salvador and Vietnam were trained in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s to essentially eliminate potential opposition, including peaceful, nonviolent opposition from human rights workers, from Indians, from church people, and from labor unions in the area. So the Ua, looking at what has happened already in northern Colombia with our already developed oil field, and seeing that the Indians in the area have essentially become in the middle of this crossfire between the Colombian army, the guerrillas, and the paramilitaries, do not want any part of oil development because they feel and already have evidence to the fact that they will themselves become involved in the crossfire between the Colombian army, the oil companies, and the guerrilla armies. There's already been several million gallons worth of oil spilled in that area just north of the reservation, several million gallons of oil, which is much larger than the Exxon Valdez spill and has had much more serious long-term consequences on the water supply and the contamination of the water supply for the surrounding communities. So the Ua population, seeing all this, have essentially put an ultimatum to the Colombian government saying that if oil development proceeds in their territory, they will commit mass suicide. And this is a threat that goes back to the colonization period when the Spanish were trying to conquer the Indian populations of Latin America, and the Ua were one of the tribes that retreated into the jungles, and as the Spanish encroached on their territory, 1,500 Ua Indians threw themselves over a cliff rather than be subjected to the slavery that was being imposed by the Spanish. So what you have in the case of the Ua in Colombia is a microcosm of what is happening with Native peoples around the world who are on lands that have valuable either energy or mineral resources, which are being sought by the national government, in this case Colombia, along with powerful multinational corporations like Occidental, and the kind of resources that the state and the corporations are bringing to bear to squash any resistance. And the kind of resources that are being brought to bear is a massive military presence backed up by $1.3 billion worth of American military aid, 70% of which goes to support the Colombian military, American military advisors, along with UE helicopters and all sorts of intelligence gathering equipment, to essentially declare that anyone who objects to mineral exploration or oil development is a terrorist and therefore is capable of being assassinated by these special units of the Colombian Armed Forces, as I said, which are trained by U.S. Central Intelligence Agency and Defense Department funds. So you have an ongoing war, a genocidal war in Colombia, where some of the first victims are native peoples, but of course they're not the only victims. You have a large-scale guerrilla insurgency going on, in which anyone who is declared to be a sympathizer of the guerrillas, and certainly the Indians have been described as sympathizers of the guerrillas because they're opposed to oil development, they are being subjected to assassination and forced displacement from their lands. The kind of responses, though, that we have seen in Colombia are also indicative of the level of political organization of native peoples resisting these kinds of developments. And so, given the emergency situation that exists in Colombia, the Indians have not been able to depend upon the Colombian government to defend their interests, because every time they bring any kind of legal challenge to the jurisdiction of the company, the courts end up overturning whatever legal rights the Indians have to their lands or to due process in being consulted about mining and oil development. And so the UA have made alliances with environmental and non-governmental organizations in the United States and in Europe that have brought the case of the UA to the shareholders of Occidental Petroleum. They brought the case to the investors in Occidental Petroleum, investors such as Fidelity Investments, which has substantial shares in Occidental and in the Colombian energy project. And what these groups have done is to put economic pressure on Fidelity Investment, asking them to withdraw their investment from Occidental because of the kinds of socially irresponsible and environmentally irresponsible policies that Occidental is supporting in Colombia. And within the last several years, Fidelity has divested itself of over half of its shares of Occidental Petroleum. At the same time, as it is denying that divestiture is related to the sophisticated organizing campaign of the non-governmental organizations. And so what you have is very concrete solidarity being practiced at an international level that has had dramatic consequences on the conflict. It hasn't ended the conflict by any means, but it has shown that it is capable of taking the concerns of a formerly isolated native population in Latin America and bringing that to the boardrooms and the economic institutional decision-making apparatus of institutions in the advanced industrial countries.
With the recent discussion that the war in Afghanistan and the continual bombings in Iraq might be related in some ways to U.S. interest in Central Asia's rich oil reserves. What are your thoughts on this, and how might these recent events be impacting ongoing indigenous or ethnic struggles in this region?
Well, if you look at the discussions in the Department of Energy and in some of the think tanks that have been concerned with energy in Central Asia, like the RAND Corporation, the Afghanistan Institute, and the Heritage Foundation, they've been talking about the rich oil reserves and rich natural gas reserves in Central Asia since the mid-1990s, and frequently they describe the oil and gas resources in the Central Asian region of the Caspian Sea, which includes all those former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, all of those formerly dependent countries in the Soviet Union, as having the potential for massive amount of oil and gas development, second only to that of the Persian Gulf. And given the instability in the Persian Gulf and the concern of energy companies with someday being unable to extract resources from the Persian Gulf, Central Asia becomes another major source of both oil and natural gas. Since the 1990s, one of the proposals in Afghanistan has been to connect the Western markets, particularly Asia, Japan, Western Europe, as consumers of oil with the vast reserves in Central Asia. The problem, however, has been that infrastructure, the pipeline infrastructure in Central Asia, has been underdeveloped. The existing routes of those pipelines are wholly within Russia, and the United States has for a long time wanted to diversify and set up sort of a competing set of pipeline routes that would make the transfer, the extraction of oil and gas less politically risky because it would go through secure countries like Afghanistan or some of the former Soviet republics, which are right now engaged in reciprocal relationships with the United States, allowing military bases on their soil. So the whole Central Asia region is an important resource area. It's also historically an area which has misused its oil resources, such that primary beneficiaries of the oil development have not been the population, the mass of the population in these countries, but a small elite that has essentially used the revenues from the oil industry as their personal and class resource, much the same way that the royal family in Saudi Arabia has monopolized the resources of oil in that region. So, and consequently, because of the monopolization of the resources in those former Soviet republics, there is growing inequality in those countries, and that growing inequality has provoked a number of ethnic and tribal clashes between different groups in the population because they're being victimized by the oil development. They're being pushed off land, their communities are being polluted, their health is being destroyed by these industries, but they're not benefiting from the revenues that are being generated. And consequently, this entire Central Asia area is rife with ethnic and tribal conflicts that are largely the result of this sudden, and in some cases not so sudden, proliferation of wealth from the oil industry. In the case of Afghanistan, well before September 11th and the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, there was substantial interest in both the Clinton administration and in the incoming Bush administration for securing stable pipeline routes that would not go through Russia. One of those favored routes, one of the most favored routes, was through Afghanistan. You had Unocal Oil that was involved in negotiating a pipeline concession from the Taliban, and you had Unocal that were wining and dining members of the Taliban, bringing them to Texas to soften them up for the contracts, and not getting very far, and eventually concluding that the Taliban was simply an unreliable investor partner, and eventually taking a negative or a hardline stance toward the Taliban, essentially arguing that oil pipeline development could not proceed as long as the Taliban was in power. Now, this is well prior to the attacks on the World Trade Center. So this is a long-term concern of the oil industry. And if you look at the people in the Bush administration that are mostly responsible for this policy, Dick Cheney, the vice president, when he was the president of Halliburton Oil Company, was negotiating contracts in Central Asia to make possible the development of these pipelines. You had people from the RAND Corporation like Zalmay Khalilzad, who's one of the chief Afghanistan advisors in the Bush administration, that was also talking about the necessity to take a hard line toward the Taliban, because otherwise we would not have the kind of political stability that would be necessary to extract oil from Central Asia.
You quoted from the meetings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change during the climate talks in Kyoto that the IPCC warned climate change will cause the greatest suffering to the poorest peoples and most pristine ecosystems globally. Now, that seems to illustrate the crux of some of these ties and concerns between climate change and indigenous struggles. But my question for you, given culturally diverse livelihood strategies and some of the customs of indigenous groups around the world, you seem to cover a lot of different groups in different regions around the world. How do you feel that such vulnerability to climate change can be sensitively and appropriately addressed and minimized?
Well, the reason why Native peoples are particularly vulnerable to climate change is because, for very complex historical reasons having to do with the way in which colonization proceeded, the Native peoples in most parts of the world have retreated to what are now called the frontier areas of the world, the uncharted, undeveloped, least geographically accessible lands to escape from the colonizers. And those least accessible lands happen to be in the vast majority of the rainforests in the world, as well as other sensitive ecosystems like the Arctic tundra or the Australian outback, the deserts in Australia, which are areas which are both remote from industrial development as well as highly biologically diverse, containing most of the world's uncharted, uncatalogued plants and animal species, and also the areas where Native peoples have been able to survive for hundreds and thousands of years. Now, this survival strategy has involved working with the resources available to Native peoples in those environments in such a way to produce a sustainable lifestyle that does not degrade the environment of those areas. When you have multinational mining and energy corporations that are now looking to these frontier areas as the new areas of development, What you're looking at are the correspondence between some of the most biologically and culturally diverse regions in the world and the existing and remaining oil and mineral basins. Mm-hmm. This has been documented by a number of different groups, including Rainforest Action Network, Project Underground, and the Worldwide Fund for Nature, mm-hmm. which have shown that the areas where the most intense oil exploration is taking place are in some of the most ecologically and culturally sensitive environments. And so any impact from these extractive activities on these environments is going to both reduce biological diversity as well as threaten the remaining native cultures in those areas. So the question then becomes, given the vulnerabilities of these native populations who are living in these areas, what are the most appropriate ways of responding to their concerns about extractive development and climate change? Mm-hmm. And the non-governmental organizations that I mentioned, like Rainforest Action Network, among others, have recommended that the most appropriate response, the most culturally sensitive response, to prevent further impoverishment and adverse health effects from global climate change on these populations is to initiate an immediate ban on new exploration for oil, gas, and fossil fuels in these frontier ecosystems. At the same time as there is a ban on new exploration, there should be an immediate transfer of public funds to subsidize renewable and decentralized forms of energy as opposed to subsidized fossil fuel extraction. And the decentralized and renewable clean energy should pay particular attention to meeting the energy needs of the poorest 2 billion people in those areas. Time after time in these energy boom areas where you have massive amounts of resources being taken out of an area, such as in Colombia or in Nigeria, what you have is a worsening of the economic conditions of the local populations where their standard of living declines. There's no running water. There's no electricity. There are no adequate roads, schools in those areas where you have the most intense extraction of energy resources, which are providing super profits for the mining and oil corporations. In addition to transferring funds from subsidizing fossil fuel extraction, the other recommendation of these organizations is for these energy corporations, which have made such huge profits off the exploitation of these third world and indigenous resources, is to invest a portion of their profits into cleaning up the messes that they have left behind in these areas. And these messes are widespread and long-lasting messes. Just to take one example, in the Niger Delta of Nigeria, yeah. Shell Oil has been accused of eco-terrorism because of its irresponsible policies of dumping untreated oil waste into local water supplies, of burning off gas flares in farming areas, which essentially destroyed the vegetation, as well as make breathing very difficult for the local populations because of all the noxious gases that are coming off these gas flares. And these are permanent disruptions of the natural ecosystem. And so one of the demands of the Global Climate Coalition that came together as a coalition of non-governmental organizations in the Kyoto meeting in Japan was mm-hmm. for the oil companies that have made these messes to invest a portion of their profits into cleaning up the messes that they've made. So the basic idea is to use the extensive mapping that has already been done by Worldwide Fund for Nature and the Rainforest Action Network, which shows that these areas, which are the most biologically and culturally diverse and also rich in resources, that they essentially be declared out of bounds for any future exploration or development, both because of their sensitivity and also because if these resources were to be developed, or for that matter, other fossil fuel resources, the implications for global climate change would be such that the poorest populations, whether it be the peasant populations or indigenous populations, be among the first to feel the effects of the disruptions caused by global climate change, including the spread of infectious diseases, the susceptibility to catastrophic weather events, whether they be hurricanes, tornadoes, volcano eruptions, or the disruption of their agricultural crops because of the changes in the weather patterns, that for all those reasons, the very fact that these resources are being contemplated to be developed or extracted by multinational oil corporations itself poses a major threat to the survival of these native populations.
Professor and activist Ravi Rajan has said that the world has rarely seen indigenous movements win on their own. And to win, we need environmental coalitions internationally. So then in your book, you describe some of these alliances within some native societies themselves, such as the Forest Peoples Alliance in Brazil, and then also grassroots environmental movements that take place between, as you might characterize it, the global north and the global south. And you mentioned that these alliances have led to more effective political leverage against various environmentally damaging policies. I was wondering if you could speak more to the importance of these alliances and perhaps discuss how you treated this idea, maybe in the context of the Ogoni land or...
Sure. For the Ogoni, who are the major native population in the oil-producing area of the Niger Delta, along with the Ija, the consequences of oil development over the past several decades has resulted in both the economic impoverishment of the area, a decline in living standards. It has also resulted in degradation of their environment with the massive pollution of the oil industry. It has made it impossible for them to conduct their subsistence farming activities or their fishing activities. And when they have demanded compensation for the losses they have experienced by the activities of Shell and British Petroleum, they have been met with the combined military repression of the Nigerian military and what are called the mobile police squads, which the Ogoni call the kill-and-go squads. These are mobile police forces that come into Ogoni villages. They carry out arbitrary arrests, detentions, extrajudicial executions of suspected leaders of the environmental protests, and then they move on without any kind of accountability. So the response of the Ogoni people to this kind of both ecological terrorism and state-sponsored terrorism has been to form self-defense organizations, Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, or MOSOP, and to mobilize people at the grassroots level. And here's where the interaction between the local indigenous grassroots organizing and international coalitions come into play, because given the position of the Nigerian government in all this collusion with the oil industry, the Ogoni realized very early on that they were not going to get any redress of their grievances from the Nigerian government. The forum then for their grievances could not be a national forum, it had to be an international forum. And so one of the leaders of the Ogoni, Ken Sarawiwa, was a poet and author prior to his assumption of leadership in this organization, used his international contacts, particularly in the United Nations and in the international human rights community, to go to Geneva, Switzerland, to talk to the UN Committee on Discrimination, to make his case, or make the Ogoni case, before international agencies, and to get other countries, particularly host countries of some of the corporations that were involved in exploiting oil in Ogoni land, like Shell Oil, whose headquarters are in England, to put pressure on those corporations to negotiate some kind of compensation package with the Ogoni people. The response of Shell Oil, in conjunction with the Nigerian government, was to arrest Ken Sarawiwa and the leaders, eight other leaders of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, charge them with these fabricated charges of murder, and execute them by hanging in 1995. This, on the surface, would appear to be a negative lesson in terms of what the consequences of making alliances between local movements and international movements, because the leaders of this movement wind up being hanged. But the larger point, of course, is that despite the fact that Ken Sarawiwa was hanged, one of the major motivations of the Nigerian government in going after Ken Sarawiwa was the mistaken belief that if they silenced Ken Sarawiwa, that the grievances of the Ogoni people would cease to be an embarrassment to the Nigerian government, and there would be less pressure put on the Nigerian government for changing its policies toward the oil development in the Niger Delta. And what happened as a result of the execution of Ken Sarawiwa was that there was even greater outpouring of international protest directed against the Nigerian military, which resulted in the Nigerian government trying to do some face-saving in the international community, particularly within the United States, because one of the proposals in the Congress at that time was a proposal to cut off military assistance to the Nigerian government and also to initiate a boycott of Nigerian oil, which would have been a major economic blow to the Nigerian government. And so the point here is that the Nigerian government motivation for going after the leaders of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People was a clear understanding that there were very important, significant international pressures that were already being brought to bear on the Nigerian government and on the way that the oil companies conducted their business. Where they miscalculated was to expect that by eliminating the leaders of the movement, that they will eliminate the issue of the inequitable distribution of power and resources in the Niger Delta. And after that experience, a new government came to power, which had to maintain a very different kind of international stance, where they recognized that something had to be done about the grievances in the Niger Delta. And what has happened is that there have been the outpourings of much more organization, not just among the Ogoni, but also among the Ijaw and other affected minorities in the oil-producing area. In fact, I would say there's an ongoing state of insurgency in the Niger oil delta because of the ability of these native populations to some extent shield themselves from the full military force of the Nigerian government and the private oil companies by bringing the human rights abuses to the attention of international agencies. In fact, if you look in the literature on the Nigerian oil experience, one of the lessons that Shell has taken from this experience was that it has to totally refurbish its image as a responsible corporation because of the black marks that it has gotten because of its treatment of Ken Saro-Wiwa and the Ogoni grassroots movement. So the point here is that the effectiveness of the coalitions that link grassroots environmental struggles in indigenous communities with larger environmental human rights organizations around the world puts some kind of increased leverage on those companies and on those countries that are engaging in massive human rights violations.
We're talking with Al Giedix from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, as he has just come out with another book entitled Resource Rebels, Native Challenges to Mining and Oil Corporations. He's also the author of New Resource Wars, Native and Environmental Struggles Against Multinational Corporations. You've been speaking a lot about some of the structural impediments to a lot of these indigenous group struggles. One of these might be considered the mainstream media and the prestige press. You talk about the role of media coverage affecting outcomes in indigenous environmental issues in different parts of your book. In the introduction, you refer to the changing role of mass media and possible improvements. It's been said that mainstream media and the prestige press have acted as linchpins in the ongoing hegemonic capitalist interests. And you talk about how this book may be interesting to those providing direction for environmentalists and anti-capitalists alike. How might these roles be changing both within the mainstream media and the prestige press, these roles being the indigenous struggles, and also through alternative forms of media? And how have you addressed these changing roles in your book?
Well, as I said in the introduction to the book, the dominant image in the media up until very recently regarding Native peoples has been to present them as either the unfortunate victims of progress and development or people that are trying to revive their quaint traditional cultures in the context of a global economy which no longer can find a place for those antiquated cultures and customs. And that image has justified and marginalized Native peoples in their real roles as actors in their own right and as people that can not only defend or that increasingly can defend their lands against some of these forces of corporate, financial, and state expropriation of their resources, but also that can do so in a way that makes an impact on the perceptions of some very powerful people in the country. And I use the example of the UWA in Colombia as a group that has impressed the financial press to the point where when Wall Street talks about Native opposition to mining projects and oil projects in the Third World, and they refer to the kind of resistance that has come out of the UWA international struggle, they talk about the voices and the words of indigenous leaders that are being directly addressed to power holders like shareholders in annual corporate meetings, or the board of directors of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, all of these governmental and financial institutions that are either funding or providing support in some way for these multinational oil and mining activities. So the kind of perception that has changed is a perception that more accurately understands that Native peoples have something very important to say, and that they are capable of translating their concerns into language that is understandable in the centers of corporate and governmental power, to the point where those corporations' investments and the decisions of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, become subjected to much more public scrutiny as a result of these kinds of Native interventions.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I talk about in the book is the convergence between the international movement in response to globalization, particularly the World Trade Organization, the policies of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, which exploded in the streets of Seattle in 1999, and in subsequent meetings in the years following, that those kinds of questioning of the international financial system coincides with the emergence of Native peoples as social and political actors on the world stage that are being listened to and being taken much more seriously by mainstream media and by the decision makers in corporations and in private financial institutions. In fact, some of the most laudatory comments about the emergence of Native peoples as political actors have come from the corporate executives of the very corporations that are being challenged by these Native people. If you look through the Oil and Gas Journal, if you look through the International Mining Journals, there are articles which are complaining about the alliances which have developed between Native peoples and their environmental and human rights allies in the developed countries that have made such an impact on policies like the Overseas Private Investment Corporation providing political risk insurance for a mine in West Papua on the island of Papua New Guinea, the western half of the island, where you have the world's largest gold mine, the third largest copper mine, on Native lands of the Amangune people that is being exploited by Freeport-McMoRan, which is a New Orleans-based corporation in alliance with Rio Tinto, which is the British mining conglomerate, that is essentially done in West Papua what Shell has done for the Ogoni in Nigeria, which is to say, push them off their traditional lands, dumped massive amounts of mine waste into their local rivers, making subsistence farming and harvesting impossible. And then when they complain about it, that is when the natives complain about it, sending in the Indonesian army as well as private security forces to assassinate and squash the resistance. Now, this is a situation where alliances between these Native peoples in West Papua have been translated into challenges to the United States Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which has provided so-called political risk insurance for the mining company, risk insurance which essentially guarantees that if their company is taken over by local people in some kind of uprising, that they will be compensated by the federal government. And one of the consequences of this coalition between Native peoples in West Papua and environmental groups in the United States has been to get this $100 million insurance policy underwritten by taxpayers in the United States canceled for the Freeport Mining Corporation because they were engaging in policies which would have the effect of inciting the local population and destroying their environment. And, of course, those policies of destroying the environment and inciting local populations against them are in direct violation of the guidelines of the insurance policy in the first place. So here is a situation where the people that are essentially in charge of assisting multinational mining companies in making investments in the third world are listening to arguments from the international human rights and native rights community to the effect that the policies which are being pursued by some of these companies are so irresponsible that they do not warrant or they do not deserve to be underwritten by insurance policies such as that which is being held by the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. You have corporations and think tanks like RAND Corporation, which have a whole volume of policy documents on what they call InfoWar, net war. And their prime example is the success of the Zapatista rebellion in southern Mexico, which started out as a military rebellion, but as the military forces of Mexico, assisted by the United States, began to encircle the Zapatistas, they switched their tactics from military confrontation to political and informational confrontations. And a lot of the information that the Zapatistas got out from their strongholds in southern Mexico got out through the internet, made their way into various environmental, human rights, native support organizations all around the world through email, through faxes, through the World Wide Web,
yeah.
And essentially put a restraining role on the Mexican government's role of military force against the Zapatista army. And what is sensational about this, and what is remarkable about this whole achievement, is, as the RAND Corporation pointed out, this is the first indigenous revolution which has brought the resources of the information revolution and the internet in the service of indigenous and grassroots movements. And this is something that is very difficult for established governments and corporations to counteract, because the whole nature of information dissemination technologies is decentralized, and the whole structure of capitalism and global oil and mining corporations is hierarchical and centralized.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, one set of actors which are relying upon mass dissemination through decentralized, uncoordinated networks. On the other hand, you have actors which are trying to repress this movement, but repressing it by relying upon centralized and coordinated actions. And what happens is that you have a stalemate arising where the military force of the Mexican government is useless against the Zapatistas, because the war is not being fought militarily, it's being fought politically.
Yeah, I'd like to back up just a moment. We were talking about oil corporations and some of the public pressure that these coalitions have caused with indigenous movements aligning themselves with international groups. And I'm just curious, it's easy in the developed countries to sort of expose larger corporations. And I'm just wondering, if we're looking ahead to the future, what some of the techniques and avenues that corporations will use to get around the scrutiny of public pressure. And I just, for an example, you have Shell Oil Corporation, and it's, you know, had a pretty good campaign to shed light on what's been going on in Nigeria. But then there's smaller companies such as Harken Oil, which is doing similar oil exploration in Costa Rica, and it's hard to get public support for that. And is this something we'll see, that maybe oil corporations will divert themselves into smaller companies?
Well, one of the techniques historically of the oil and mining industry is to put the focus of their activities on their subsidiaries and their affiliates, and minimize the chain of command or the chain of responsibility that subjects them to criticism of what their subsidiaries and affiliates are doing on a local level. And of course, if you can make it very difficult to trace, you know, who the parent company is and who the responsible parties are for these small oil companies, then it makes it that much more difficult to target those companies and to develop the corporate campaigns around those activities. However, one of the consequences of the international environmental movement and the native rights movement in recent years has been to compile a database looking at the corporate interconnections between various parts of the mining and oil industry, the chain of command, the corporate responsibility dimension of these activities, so that whenever these apparently unrelated, you know, independent, you know, small fly-by-night companies, so to speak, come into an area, which makes it very difficult for local people to generate publicity about the company and what the company is doing, these networks are available to exchange information about how these various actors, however small, are related to larger networks, whether the larger networks be parent companies or, in most cases, financial institutions, which are providing a lot of the money, a lot of the investment, which is necessary to conduct these activities in the first place. And one of the consequences of the current state of the assault on native people's lands and resources is that the scale of the projects which are being proposed and developed in these native areas, because of the remoteness of the area, because of the large-scale nature of the project, the capital that is required to finance these exploration and development projects are beyond the capability of most small corporations, and even beyond the capability of most large corporations, which requires then international financing through the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and so on. And once you have, you know, a very clear understanding of what the flow of money is into these projects, what you then have is a blueprint for attacking the most vulnerable parts of these corporate activities. And it doesn't make any difference whether you have Harkin Corporation or Shell Oil Corporation, as long as you can make the appropriate connection between where Harkin is getting the money versus where Shell is getting the money, because the same institutions are usually behind both activities, whether Harkin or Shell Oil Corporation. And I think one of the most significant findings in the last couple of years regarding a lot of these mining and oil activities is that the widespread assumption is, both within the financial community as well as within much of the academic community, is that despite the social and environmental costs of these activities, the overall result of these development projects result in an increase in the standard of living of the population or some kind of economic improvement. And that's the ultimate justification for these so-called side effects or unfortunate casualties of the projects. And what is happening is that that basic assumption about the economic benefit that derives from this activity is being challenged with data that is looking at what the experience of the last 20 years has been in these oil and mining areas. And what academics are coming up with is a statistical survey which shows that there is no identifiable economic benefit of these activities for the populations, whether they be the local populations or the national populations in those areas. And so groups like Friends of the Earth, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, and others are now asking the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to essentially divest themselves of all funding of mining and oil activities, because the ostensible justification for those activities on the part of the institutions themselves is that somehow this is going to alleviate poverty in these areas. And what the statistical evidence shows is that there is no evidence to suggest that that is, in fact, the result of these activities.
Just have one more question for you. And just talking in addition to some of these divestment campaigns and talking, perhaps if you could give us your thoughts on what more people, we listeners, could do to support some of these indigenous struggles and how your book may help in continuing to give voice to these important and vital issues.
Well, I think if you look at what's happening with the energy efficiency and conservation movements, where people are putting pressure on government and corporations to shift from fossil fuel extraction to clean renewable sources of fuel, to much more efficient appliances, including cars, efficiencies in automobile mileage, as well as investments in renewable energy. I mean, there's a whole range of activities which consumers in the advanced industrial countries are already concerned about for reasons of environmental and health impacts that will, if they are successful, alleviate some of the pressures of the assault on Indian lands and other parts of the world. There's also an increasing awareness, especially since September 11th, of the role of the United States in training what can only be described as terrorist groups in different parts of the world that act on behalf of American oil interests or international oil interests in places like Colombia. And there are, you know, increasing pressures on the United States government, first of all, not to fund a war on the peasantry and Indians in Colombia, and secondly, to shut down institutions like the School of the Americas, which are responsible for training many of the people that are engaging in massive human rights violations in Colombia and all over the third world. So I would say that the environmental movement and the anti-war, the peace movement that has targeted military assistance to Colombia, as well as military assistance in Nigeria and Burma and other military dictatorships, is a very concrete and critical means of Americans supporting the struggles of indigenous peoples to maintain their lands and their cultures.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the air and speaking with us this evening.
That was Al Giedix, professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, and the author of Resource Rebels, speaking with Roots and Culture of Free Radio Santa Cruz.
If all this blood for oil is getting you down, there's good news. There is a way to immediately reduce the need for oil exploration and the wars and killing that are part and parcel of it, and also drastically reduce greenhouse gases that are causing global warming, with the use of a fuel you can make in your basement. It's called biodiesel. Andrea DeFrancesco has been involved with biodiesel research and development for several years, and she even runs her own pickup truck on it. She spoke with Radioactive, at WERU in Maine.
Biodiesel is an alternative fuel, first of all. It's an alternative to diesel fuel. It's made out of vegetable oil. So it's, number one, a renewable. And number two, it's domestically produced. And number three, it cuts emissions drastically. So basically what it is, it's a fuel that's made out of vegetable oil. You take vegetable oil that's either virgin, has never been used for anything, or that has been used to in a friolator, like to fry French fries or donuts, and you cut it with a certain percentage of lye and methyl alcohol, and you stir them all together and let it sit. And the glycerin on the vegetable oil molecule actually drops off, and what you have left over are what is called methyl esters, and that's what you burn in your diesel engine. So it's an alternative diesel fuel. You can't burn it in just any gasoline engine. You can only burn it in a diesel engine. And the interesting thing about diesel engines is that although we tend to think of them as being exclusively petroleum motors, they were originally diesel engines were invented to run on peanut oil or oils like that. And the word diesel comes from Rudolf Diesel, who invented the engine. But just at the time that he was inventing this engine, the petroleum industry was getting very strong. And so they were able to exert their influence and make all diesels start running on petroleum because it was abundant and cheap at the time. So once you've made this biodiesel, is what we call it, you can run it in any diesel engine without doing any kind of conversion whatsoever to the motor, which is why it's such an exciting alternative fuel, because these days a lot of alternatives necessitate the conversion of the vehicle. So if you have a fleet of school buses that are diesels and you want them to run cleaner, a lot of times people will want to run them on propane or compressed natural gas. And that means that they have to change all the running equipment in the school bus, and they have to retrain the people who work on the school buses, and they have to put in alternative infrastructure. But with biodiesel, all of that remains the same. You can mix biodiesel in any quantity with regular diesel, and you can switch back and forth, and you can run 100% biodiesel, or you could switch all the way back to regular diesel. And so you don't have to set up any different kind of infrastructure, and the maintenance is exactly the same because you're not changing your engine.
How did you get interested in this? How did you learn about it, first off?
I learned about it about 7 years ago, maybe a little less. I've always been interested in alternative fuels, and I do a lot of work on engines and on cars. For two reasons I'm interested in alternative fuels. One, because of the emissions that come out are so obviously detrimental to, you know, our environment and to our health. But the other thing is just working on these motors is, you know, it's really nasty. It's, you get covered in this, you know, in this diesel, and you get covered in, you know, all the, and you're breathing all the exhaust all the time. And it's you know, it's not nice to see all your mechanic friends get sick once they turn 60. And, you know, I mean, it's a real, real thing that, you know, you can really see the effects of these poisons that we're relying on to transport us. And there's so many other ways to provide transportation to ourselves that aren't poisonous. And this one is, I found most attractive because it's renewable, it's domestic, and it's so easy. It's so easy to do. And there's other better alternatives which will be coming online at some point, like hydrogen fuel cells, for example. But those you have to change everything in order to do that. This is something that, you know, you could be running on a terribly, you know, polluting diesel bus today, and tomorrow you could be running biodiesel. It's available commercially, but it's also something that you can make at home, which is also something that makes it very, you know, unique and desirable, so that someone who owns a diesel vehicle could just begin making, with very little trouble, could begin making the fuel themselves. And the way you do that, we're not going to just go through the whole recipe, but if people are interested, they can contact me and I'll give that information later. You basically just, if you wanted to make it at home, you could collect waste fat from behind the Dunkin' Donuts or behind, you know, Duffy's. And mostly people don't mind, you know, they don't have much, they usually have to pay someone to get rid of it anyway. So you go and collect it, and you could mix it, you know, if you wanted to mix 5 gallon batches of it, you would get your methyl alcohol, which is basically dry gas, but you can also get it in larger quantities in other places, and your lye, which is basically Red Devil lye drain cleaner, but you can also get it in more pure forms. But that's the basic. And you determine the quantities of those two substances that you need to mix with the vegetable oil based on the pH of the fat that you've collected. And you mix those all together for a certain amount of time. You could use a blender if you're making a tiny little batch just to test, or you can use a big paint stirrer on the end of a electric drill if you want. And then you mix them all up, and then you let them settle, and it just, the glycerin drops off. You know, the glycerin separates from the methyl esters, and you can really see it's a straight cut. You can really see where the glycerin and the fuel divide, and then you just draw off the fuel and strain it and burn it in the motor. It's a fairly simple process. And
how much of it does it take? How much do you get a lot of miles per gallon to? I'm just trying to get a sense of, like,
yeah,
would you have to be?
The mileage of the biodiesel to regular diesel is essentially the same. Hmm. And it's the same performance. We have some people have recorded a slight drop in power, but we've also had other people who have recorded an increase in power. And that's the interesting thing about biodiesel is, in addition to it cutting emissions, which I'll go back to in a second and tell some exact figures, but it also runs in the engine better, especially with the increased emissions standards that are being imposed by the government. They're being required to clean up the diesel fuel. And one of the major things that they're doing is taking the sulfur out. And taking the sulfur is a real lubricator. And a lot of diesel engines are fuel lubricated. So the pumps and things inside the engines are lubricated by the fuel. So once the sulfur is taken out of the diesel, we've been seeing a lot more wear on the internal parts of a diesel engine. With the biodiesel, there's no sulfur in it to begin with, and the lubricity is incredible. And there's been studies where they have run engines, similar engines on diesel and on biodiesel, and then taken them apart and examined them. And the engines run on the biodiesel have had less wear and tear on them because of the increased lubricity. Biodiesel is a more oxygenated fuel, which means it has more efficient combustion. And when you put it in a motor, it really smooths the motor out. It quiets it. And we had one thing, I was working out in Oakland, California, at a place called Cytoculture with someone named Randall von Wedel, who's been researching biodiesel and using it for a long time. And we had gotten a place called the Berkeley Ecology Center to switch all of its recycling trucks over to biodiesel, 100% biodiesel. And they had about 12 big Volvo recycling trucks, big old garbage trucks. And the day that we switched them over to biodiesel, they would pull the diesel trucks up there, belching their black smoke and turn them off, and we'd pump them full of biodiesel, and they'd start them back up, and they'd just be puffing a little bit of white smoke. And it was just, I mean, you know, all of us had seen the biodiesel running before, but it was just such a, you know, a blatant difference that it was so exciting to see just how wonderful it was. And some of the guys who drove the trucks didn't realize that the trucks had been switched over. They were reporting increased power and was wondering what was going on. And there's been other cases where people have switched their fleets and didn't tell the drivers, they didn't tell the maintenance people, and that drivers would come back saying, you know, oh, have the vehicles been tuned up, because they were running so much better.
Can you give us some examples of people around the country or around the world that are using biodiesel right now?
In California, there's a lot more, because the emission standards are so much more stringent that fleets have been forced to look for alternatives to diesel, because they're further along in their cleanup process. So there's various national parks that are beginning to use it, for one thing. There's higher air standards in national parks. So I think the first national park was the Channel Islands National Park in California that was brought on due to the hard work of Randall von Wedel of Cytoculture in California. And there's, I think, the longest running fleet is in the township of Medford, New Jersey. And that's been running since 1997. That's a school bus fleet that has been running on biodiesel year-round since 97. And in between, there's, I know Cincinnati has run on it, Chicago buses run on it, there's buses in Arizona, there's lots of school bus fleets across the country, and more city buses. Also, airports are getting more and more interested in it. The San Francisco airport, for their ground transportation, because these bigger airports have lots of diesel buses that act as shuttles and, you know, run all over the airport, just belching out all of these horrible emissions all the time. And
a lot of them are starting to run on the biodiesel now, too. We just this Thursday had a meeting with Acadia National Park. They have been talking with a distributor called World Energy out of Cambridge, who distributes biodiesel. And Acadia National Park is very interested in using it for their diesel equipment. The other thing that I didn't mention is that biodiesel can be used in place of home heating oil. And that's also something that they're looking into. It runs, you know, just like, you know, home heating oil and diesel are the same thing. So you can just put it into your home heating system if you burn oil. And so the park does heat a lot of buildings with oil. So right now they're going and looking at the viability of getting it shipped into the area. The city of Bangor is very interested in running its municipal vehicles on it. The city of Portland has gotten very, very interested. In addition to, there's many people in the area that I've talked to who are interested in running their private vehicles on it, or just, you know, interested in finding out more about it. I should probably say now about the emissions, why people are so interested in addition to the fact that it's a, you know, it's a domestically produced fuel, which makes, you know, it's pretty attractive to be able to produce our fuel in our own country. But the emissions, the cut in emissions is incredible. And if you burn 100% biodiesel, you're cutting the total hydrocarbons by 93%. I mean, yeah, by 93%. The carbon monoxide by 50%, the particulate matter by 30%, the sulfates by obviously 100% because there's no sulfur in it. And those are just some of the cuts that you see, that some of the most dramatic ones. And like I was saying before, you can run biodiesel in any amount with petroleum diesel. And a real popular way to run it that has been approved on a federal level and has the backing of a lot of equipment manufacturers, so it won't compromise your warranty, to run on B20, which is 20% biodiesel in 80% regular diesel. And just running it 20% cuts the hydrocarbons by 30%, the carbon monoxide by 20%, the particulate matter by 22%. The one thing that doesn't drop is the nitrogen oxides. Those go up slightly, but it's 2% with 20% biodiesel. There's a lot of research being done on the nitrogen oxides. Those are worrisome because they are one of the greenhouse producers, but only when in combination with other emissions. So the other emissions are being cut if you use biodiesel. So there's the overall effect is one of a decrease in potential greenhouse deterioration.
Now, Home Incorporated is thinking about getting a pump right here in Orland. That's
one of the thoughts. Yeah, Home Incorporated in Orland is very, very interested in the fuel as well, and they're just exploring their options and what resources they would need to, you know, what infrastructure they need to set up. But their you know, final goal would be they would like to produce it here, and they would also like to open a pump to open it to the public so that you could just pull up and fill up your diesel vehicle with the fuel. And they would, that's something that they have a lot of interest in it. One of the biggest things with this fuel is that because it's an alternative and not many people are using it, that it does, there's a price increase because you have to pay extra for the shipping because it's not just everywhere. So that's why it's exciting that Acadia and Bangor are interested in it, because if they start purchasing it in larger amounts, then the price drops dramatically. To have large amounts shipped up on a regular basis means, you know, a steady market for it, and instead of sporadic, you know, deliveries of 55 gallons or whatever.
I think the Audubon Expedition bus, I think I read somewhere that they're using that or considering using that. Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't, but that's possible. There's so much interest in it. Just in the past year, it's amazing. When I was working out in Oakland, I started working on it, I guess, the summer of last year, and there was hardly anything going on with it. There was, you know, we were, you know, trying to get interest here and there, and the price was very, very high because there was only sporadic shipments coming into, I was working in the Bay Area, and there was only sporadic shipments of it. I went away for 2 months and I came back, and in those 2 months, from nothing being shipped into that area, there were two rail cars full being shipped on a regular basis into that area. The price had dropped by over $1 a gallon. I mean, it was, you know, it's very, the interest in it has just been growing and growing and growing, and just as people are learning more about it. And one thing that I encounter a lot of people saying who are skeptical is, you know, when I first start talking about it and wanting to put it in the equipment, is if it was such a great thing, then everybody would be using it. And, it, you know, why isn't everybody using it if it's such a great thing? Well, it's because people don't know about it. The more people know about it, the more people use it, and people are having a lot of satisfaction with it.
Great. And you've also considered the potential of using it in boats as well, marine.
Yeah, it's really nice for
being used on COA on the island generators.
Yep.
Their offshore operations, they have it for backup power for their generators, and they use it in a tractor there. Camp Chewonki is actually making their own. A man named Peter Arnold down there is producing it on a fairly large level. There's some of the schooners offshore here are running on it. There's, endless people are using it.
So how can people get in touch with you, or are there other places that they can go for more information about this?
There are. There's a lot of places that they can go. First of all, they can contact me. I'm Andrea DiFrancesco, and they can call 469-6235. And if I'm not there, you can leave a message. There's a distributor called World Energy, and they're out of Cambridge. They have a lot of information. You can talk to Keith Chiampa, and his number is 617-889-7300. And Cytoculture and Rando von Wedel, who has just a vast amount of knowledge about it because he's been studying it for probably longer than anybody in the country, is 510-233-0102, or you can find him on the computer at www.cytoculture.com/biodiesel. And cytoculture is spelled CYTOCULTURE. And you can reach World Energy on your little computer at www.worldenergy.net. And those are just some good starting places. There's scores more, but those are just starting spots.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Andrea DiFrancesco speaking with Radioactive of WERU in East Orland, Maine.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.